you've just started to see, you know, bald motherfuckers like Larry Fink going on CNBC talking about like fiscal responsibility and all sorts of other bullshit that we've been banging on drums for the last like 15 years. Like the sales force is just starting around the world of, hey, you know, put your assets here. We'll protect you against inflation. You maybe made 10x on some shitcoin that you bought and you sold that. Now, the shit's going 1,000 times higher. Like, it's not even there yet.
Hey, everyone, if you have been listening to Empire, you know that Santi and I are fed up with unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds that make the on-chain experience basically unusable. So the Arbitrum team reached out and they showed us the platform. They showed us what you can do on Arbitrum. Whatever you're doing, you can experience frictionless transactions at lightning speed on Arbitrum. So head over to portal.arbitrum.io and check it out. What's up, everyone? Before we jump into today's episode, I'm excited to share Empire's first ever security partner. Harpy is the best tool to prevent your wallet from theft in real time. Harpy is not just a security solution, they are a peace of mind solution. But don't just take our word for it. Harpy is the only wallet security solution that protected 100% of its users from attacks like the Ledger one in Q4, which was an off-chain signature attack. To learn more about Harpy, click the link in the show notes or visit harpy.io/empire. All right, everyone. Welcome back to Empire. We've got Guy from Athena Labs, and we have Arthur Hayes joining us. So, Arthur, Guy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, pumped for this. Arthur, I thought it'd be fun to actually pick on you to start. You've been writing about stablecoins for, I don't know, as long as I have been reading you, whether it's like, you know, I remember the Luna Brothers piece from 2022. There was an article from 2021 talking, that I remember when you were writing about stablecoins, like, the height of the last market, basically, you were calling for a change in stablecoins. I'd be curious, like, what is your story of both thinking about stablecoins, but also like meeting Guy and getting involved in Athena?
Yeah. So, I mean, stablecoins and Tether was kind of the pioneer of this back in, 2015 when they started, whatever it was. Right. So back when I used to trade a lot more and, you know, be more involved in the exchange scene, you know, when I started in 2013, after MT. Gox failed, then banking became a really big issue for the entire crypto ecosystem. And exchanges lost big accounts. Like, I remember back in the day, Bitfinex had an HSBC account. And, you know, you had major banks, unbeknownst to probably their compliance departments, had crypto exchanges that were using them. But once MT. Gox failed and that whole shit show went down and there was more scrutiny around crypto, you started seeing banking become a lot bigger issue for a lot of the major exchanges. And so they played this cat and mouse game where, you know, for a time it was Taiwan, where all the exchanges found some Taiwanese banks that were cool with crypto. And then the Taiwanese banks corresponded bank in the U.S. said, we don't want more crypto. So they kicked everybody out. And so it became this constant back and forth. And into the breach stepped, you know, Tether, which was like, hey, how we're able to do it, we're able to keep a bank account, you can stuff some dollars here, and we're going to give you this US dollar token that's going to ride around the crypto exchange ecosystem. And basically, you as the exchange don't need to have banking relationships. And that was very important. And obviously, you have exchanges like Binance. Binance, I don't even know if they have a bank account even today. Started no bank account. Still has no bank account, probably. And they, you know, their whole order book was based on Tether pairs. So stablecoins as a concept of, we want to bridge, how do I get fiat into crypto when the banking system is hostile for obvious reasons, there's this stablecoin thing. And so, you know, Tether started very small, and obviously now it's like 100 billion AUM. And my whole, I guess, problem with Tether is not that they're shady or they're lying about the reserves or any of that FUD shit that you hear on the internet. I think Tether is a great business. It's run very well. My problem is that Tether relies on the banking system to exist. If the banking system says, we don't want to have this proto US dollar bank servicing crypto, it's very trivial for them to cut off all the banking relationships with Tether. We know the five banks that they deal with. It would be literally a phone call from any regulator or any major bank saying, we don't want to have Tether in the system anymore. And boom, Tether's gone. Right? And we have to deal with that shit show, the DPEG, redemptions, blah, 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 trading mayhem. So we have this great product that we need as crypto ecosystem, yet we're relying on the TradFi motherfuckers to give us access to this product. And so my thinking was, well, why are we doing this? We have derivatives. We have crypto. We don't need to use the banking system. We can create a synthetic dollar by combining, you know, and originally my thought was Bitcoin and a short futures contract or a short perpetual swap, the inverse types that were margined in Bitcoin. And we can create this synthetic dollar. And we can use a synthetic dollar throughout the ecosystem for anyone who wants to park money into crypto, into a crypto dollar that can ride around the ecosystem when they don't want to own Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of the other shit coins. And so I've written about this concept, you know, many times in different flavors throughout the many years that I've been, you know, writing the Crypto Trader Digest. And then I penned this article, Dust on a Crust, calling again, like, we have this big issue in our ecosystem, in our market structure. We're relying on Tether and Circle and First Digital and, you know, Binance USD when it existed. These companies that just hold dollars in bank accounts to power a lot of the trading pairs. Why don't we use something that's owned and operated by one of us, where the exchanges themselves are owners and the exchanges themselves have a vested interest in making sure this survives because they want to make more money? And so it's like, well, why don't we just revive this concept of a synthetic dollar that's created with crypto and a short perpetual swap position? And I wrote this article about a year ago, and I, you know, guy read it and sort of started working on it. And we kind of crossed paths in the summer of 2023 and sort of, you know, the rest is history.
So Guy, did Athena come out of that post, or did you have the idea and you basically brought it to Arthur? And he's like, you're like, I know you're talking about this, I've got this idea. Or is it, hey, you've got this idea, I think I can go build it?
It was actually slightly earlier than that. So it was that Lunar Bros piece that you actually mentioned just after it went down in 22. That was actually when I sort of resigned from my job and started to think about Athena more seriously. But it was when at the beginning of last year that Arthur put out the Dust and Crust. That's when I started to step it up a bit more seriously and like put a team around it and that kind of stuff. So it had been something that I've been thinking about for a while. We'd seen like previous iterations of this similar idea on chain in the past, where they tried to do it like purely using decentralized exchanges. And I found that like just intellectually a very interesting type of idea on chain. And so yeah, it'd been something I've been thinking about for a while, but it was only really until a year ago when we started to really work on it seriously.
Nice. Arthur, why do you think this is the right... I remember that, I think it was the Dust on a Crust, and it was like one NUSD equals, I think it was $1 of Bitcoin plus short one Bitcoin USD inverse perp swap, something like that. But why is this the right model? There's been like the Luna model, obviously that's a whole different debacle, but like, do you remember Basis from 2018? There's been like these algo stable coins. Like there's been like a whole array of basically stable coins that have launched. Like, why is this the model that you've kind of like centered on as the right one?
So the first thing is, I don't think that we need to be decentralized. We're the stablecoin itself. We want to take this fiat money thing that is definitely not decentralized. It's useful to us in our ecosystem, yet we don't want to rely on the banking rails. So let's take the decentralization aspect out of it. If once you remove that, then the space of what you can do becomes a lot easier. We have these exchanges, they're centralized entities. They have a vested interest in trading and crypto happening much more efficiently to generate more fees, and they need a fiat pair for some of their trading pairs. So, and they also offer derivatives. So why don't we use these exchanges, these products that are battle hardened tested, right? The perpetual swap, you know, BitMEX launched in 2016. It's been very successful. Every single major exchange has a perp swap, the most traded product ever in crypto history. Let's use it. It works. There's a funding rate. We have history of it. We know how it behaves in bear markets and bull markets. Let's combine the two. The math obviously works. And let's create a synthetic dollar for real and trust the centralized entities in crypto that have a vested interest in this ecosystem surviving to safeguard this system. And so I think that this has always been a great idea. It's just we have to be hit in the head a few times to sort of come around and saying, well, let's trust ourselves to build something that we want to use for trading.
Can we talk about like prior iterations? Guy, you alluded to this in a decentralized context of like a tokenized hedge fund. So like, can you just go through maybe prior false starts and why they didn't work and what about Athena is different and gives you conviction that it will work?
Yeah, I think we saw two examples. So one was UXD on Solana back in 21, and there was another project called Lemma who tried to do the same thing on Ethereum. I think the very basic answer to your question is the derivative market is just like nowhere near as big to think about scaling this in a secure way on chain. So just for your context, like CeFi versus DeFi, open interest is roughly like 30 times larger. And you can't even really think about like DEXs as a single pool of liquidity because all of the main DEXs are actually split across different chains. And it's very difficult to sort of pull that together into a single source to actually use as one pool of liquidity. So the very simple answer is that it's basically just impossible at the moment, even with the market having grown since then on chain, to do this even like beyond nine figures of size. I think that we also looked at what was done, and I think was actually done. It was slightly reckless, I think, within like the risk management. So to do this like product on a single venue, I think is actually quite dangerous because when there's a single venue that can be where the funding can actually be pushed down by either just like the project itself or other people on there, it doesn't allow you to sort of diversify that funding risk across different venues. And so if you said to me, you could only do this on Binance, which controls like roughly 40 to 50% of the SEC open interest now, I still wouldn't do that product if it was just on Binance, which is, 15 times larger than the whole DeFi together. So yeah, it was very explicit trade-offs that we made, which is we thought that users would value scalability and a product that was actually useful at size over some of the decentralization pieces that those other projects offered. And we thought that that was, if we were honest to our users around the trade-offs that we were making, we thought that was something that you could accept if we made some work around how we're interfacing with custodians. So we can jump into how we're trying to reduce some of the counterparty risk to exchanges. But that was a very key piece, which is trying to actually isolate the credit risk of the collateral outside of centralized exchanges, which we think is like a nice middle ground between DeFi and CeFi.
For those who missed our episode that we did a couple of weeks ago on Athena, maybe you could just kind of set the stage basically, right? So you guys launched like a month ago, I think 800 million TVL, 35,000 users, kind of took over the narrative for a little bit. Can you just kind of outline Athena for anyone who might have missed that? And then we can get into some of the risks, like, the collateral side of things and funding risk and concept of a stable coin, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, sure. So it was roughly two weeks ago from now that we came out with the public mainnet. That was just allowing users to come in and try the product with capped ceilings as we sort of opened up. So we're pretty focused on ensuring that it was a pretty secure rollout and not just allowing this to grow as quickly as it could without constraints. So the idea is that users can come in, they can buy either USD or SUSD, and we've split up the tokens between, in the same way that DAI and SDAI have approached things, which is you've got a stable unit, which is like the synthetic dollar, which is USDE. And then SUSD is where you stake that same token to capture the yield that's being generated from two sources within Athena. So you've got the staked ETH returns and then the basis from the futures market, which have been being put together in the same instrument. I think what we think is interesting about that is that I think crypto has like a bit of an obsession around yield, but it's one of like the biggest dislocations where everyone's obsessed with yield, but there's no like real actual source of cash flow within crypto outside of basically people paying for Ethereum block space and paying for leverage. That's really like the only place that people pay billions of dollars for like real yield. And so like really SUSD, you can just think about putting together the only two forms of scalable crypto native yield in a single instrument. And it happens that like the output of that is a dollar-like instrument. So that's how we split between USD and SUSD. And yeah, as you said, we've had reasonably strong growth since we came out in about 2 weeks ago, and just sitting at over 800 million of supply at the moment.
Cool. Guy, do you want to get into some of the maybe common criticisms about it? So you guys launched, and I think there's some, like, there's the funding risk criticism, there's the I can do the trade myself side of things, there's the custodial and counterparty risk. Maybe you could walk us through some of these like common criticisms and kind of debunk them one by one.
Yeah, sure. So I think the funding risk is one that I think gets people's attention the most, but it's probably the one that I'm like least concerned around out of like all of the different risks that sits around this. So the very basic idea here is that like there's usually contango within ETH and BTC markets where you're getting paid to short, and like roughly the market is generally long and willing to pay for that leverage to be long. So on the funding risk, I think it's one that I'm actually least concerned around relative to I think the attention that I got within the market. And the very basic idea here is that usually you're getting paid to be short within crypto. There's a natural long bias to the market and they want to pay for that leverage to get long. So yeah, naturally the markets tend to pay for leverage to be long. And Athena is obviously sitting on the other side of that trade where you're capturing the funding basis from others who are paying for that leverage and are expressing like a long bias. You do see that flip through time. So I think we can look back at 2022 as a reasonable case for how would something like this perform when basically every large entity within the space was blowing up and going to zero. And I think one interesting piece was that basically funding averaged like just around zero through that period. That's not to say that like the data that you look back in time can always project what's going to happen in the future, because obviously Athena is going to have a pretty material role in the market if we're successful in terms of how you think about that rate going forward. I think what I'd just urge people to do is actually just think about it slightly differently. That I think everyone had this assumption that Athena is going to get so big and push the funding into negative territory. But you've actually just got to think about the funding within the market as basically an exogenous interest rate to Athena system. And people are just going to express what is the level of interest rate that they are happy to hold this product. And if they are not happy to hold it at a lower level, they're going to be stepping out of the product. And in doing so, you have to lift the shorts, which allows the funding to mean revert. So I can give just like one example here, which is the funding has been like roughly between 25 to, as of yesterday, 65% for shorting ETH. There is going to be like a demand slope for everyone within the market where they look at this product versus like RWAs or USDC in the market, and they decide, I'm willing to hold Athena's USDE versus these other products at whatever spread to like RWAs as an example. And if that does get too close to other things that they can hold within the market, they're going to be swapping out and just going into a different instrument. And that has like a self-correcting like piece to the mechanism, which is if people are happy to hold it at 12 and it starts to get pushed down closer to 5, they'll step out and allow it to main revert. So yeah, I think on the funding piece, we see it as a self-correcting mechanism. It's a market set interest rate, and Athena is really just like responding to demand and supply in the market for that interest rate.
All right, I mentioned them in the pre-roll. Now I'm going to bring them up again. It's Arbitrum. Santi and I are really fed up with these high fees, and we're really excited to have teamed up with Arbitrum for the next couple of months on Empire. As the leading Ethereum scaling solution, Arbitrum now powers hundreds of decentralized apps across DeFi, perps, NFTs, gaming, and a whole lot more. The team has showed us everything in the ecosystem, both now and what's to come, and we're really, really excited about it. Arbitrum allows both daily users and developers to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. The way the team got me excited was through portal.arbitrum.io. So my call to action to you is to get started by visiting portal.arbitrum.io. Go experience on-chain like it was meant to be. For a lot of Empire listeners, your crypto is not just another number on a screen. It's part of your future. I know Santi and myself feel that way. Our security sponsor of this episode, Harpy, takes this responsibility seriously and is the only wallet security tool that shields users from both on-chain threats and sneaky off-chain signature attacks. If you've ever been in that situation where you're moving quickly, you approve something on-chain, and you realize that the address might be a dubious address, or you're really hoping that you could take that back, Harpy has you covered. Harpy can redirect your assets to your self-custodied vault, ensuring they remain completely under your control, safe and sound. With Harpy's always-on monitoring, you're not just detecting threats, you're actively blocking and recovering compromised assets from malicious transactions before they can even confirm on-chain. Harpy is the only wallet security solution that protected 100% of its users from attacks like the Ledger one in Q4, which was an off-chain signature attack. So if you're serious about protecting your crypto investments, it's time to make the switch. Secure your wallet for free at harpy.io/empire. That's Harpy, harpy.io/empire. If you want it to be even easier, just click the link in the show notes.
Arthur, when you sat down and like reviewed this, what's the biggest risk to Athena? Like when you think about this and in light of all the things that have gone wrong with stablecoins in the past?
Biggest risk is counterparty risk. So Athena requires the centralized exchanges to perform their function. Number one function, make sure that P&L is transferred between winners and losers. So if Athena is a winner because the market goes down on their short perp or futures positions, they have to be confident that that P&L can be paid out. And so what could cause that P&L not to be paid out? Somebody blows up on the other side. There's automatic deleveraging. There's socialized losses, something of that nature, depending on how the different exchange operates. So that's one issue. The second issue is if the exchange gets hacked or steals the collateral that Athena has put on the platform. Now, Athena has obviously tried to mitigate that by using third-party custodians. But then you also have counterparty risk to the third-party custodian. Have they built their tech correctly? Blah, 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 right? So it's a counterparty risk issue. It's the same, you know, overarching risk that Tether has. Who's Tether's counterparty? The U.S. banking system. So you choose one. Do I want to bet on the U.S. banking system helping crypto to survive, or do I want to bet on the centralized crypto exchanges to help this product survive. And so you have to choose whichever risk that you want to take. There is no risk-free in this situation.
Can we double-click on the funding rates in like a day like yesterday when there's a huge wipeout? Arthur, of course, like we have a lot of data on funding rates historically, which, you know, you can model these out with like certain confidence intervals and, you know, but I'm curious, like, I noticed that you guys, I think, updated the insurance fund, part of the proceeds to make it larger. I may have seen an update like shortly after you launched. Talk to us about like in an extreme scenario, because every time you think like you model it out, like crypto always fucking surprises me in terms of, you know, some black swan happens. And so how do funding rates like behave in extreme scenarios? And in your mind, like what kind of analysis have you done in terms of like what would be the worst that could happen when the insurance fund may not be as large, but your TVL grows, you know, 10x? You know, what is that relationship? And, you know, what would happen in those extreme scenarios?
Yeah, so I think there's just probably two pieces to match to this. So one piece we didn't jump into in the beginning was part of the core change that we made to Arthur's idea was actually thinking about placing Bitcoin with staked Ethereum as the collateral asset within Athena's backing to start with, at least. And part of that, it's actually less driven to like generate yield within a bull market because staked ETH returns of 3.5% to 4% now. It's not that interesting versus the basis that you're capturing within on the short side of this. So of the composition of returns right now for SUSD, it's like less than 5% right now is coming from staked ETH returns. The reason it's actually there is for more of a bear market. And if you do get to like zero or negative funding, that's actually your first line of defense, which is you've got a positive interest rate there to help cover for some of that. And so if you just overlay the staked ETH on top of the funding rates as well, and if you sort of split up like the days that you look back in time, it's roughly only like 10% of days out of 100, like 10% out of 100, where you see negative funding actually exceed the staked ETH returns. So that's just one piece there, which we think is like a helpful defense mechanism and actually just like a first margin of safety. The second one is around the sizing of the insurance fund. We had a very interesting like moment in time at the back end of 2022. If you guys remember the merge, there was an arbitrage trade that was going on to get the ETH proof of work airdrop where people were long spot and then short the futures, and then you'd collect the proof of work airdrop and then basically dump it for like a risk-free return. That's functionally very similar to what Athena is doing, which is like long ETH on one side and then short the futures. And you actually just saw like the entire market go down into roughly negative 100% funding territory for a few weeks while people were doing that trade. And so if you run that out, it looks very different to the type of risks that you see with like an algo stablecoin, which goes to zero in 24 hours. Here you could be at the bottom band there where these exchanges like cap out how negative the funding can actually be. And roughly it comes out to 9 basis points of loss a day on in that scenario. So we've sized the insurance fund and are sizing it with that sort of scenario in mind. And the idea here is that on top of all of those mechanisms that sit there, I would just point out that it is quite irrational for a user to see a negative interest rate and still remain within the product. And if they decide that they want to step out into something that is either zero or positive yielding, that obviously helps to remedy the situation, and it's a self-correcting mechanism. So I don't want to dismiss the risk. It does exist, but the risk is very different in terms of what you actually lose versus something like an algo stablecoin that goes to zero. And I would also just say that you've always got to contextualize these risks relative to return as well. So it's mm-hmm. like a very like simplistic analysis to just say like USDC versus USDE, because with USDC, it's like return-free risk where you're taking the risk of a deep egg, like we saw in March of 23, and you're getting paid nothing to be an unsecured creditor to Circle. While here, if you're getting paid 65%, like you were last week, or 30 or 20 or whatever that number is, you've got to contextualize like the potential loss that you could have in a negative like funding scenario relative to the return that you've actually held through the entire life of this, right? So if in a year's time, this is at 1.3 on SUSDE, and you lose 9 bips a day in a negative funding scenario, it looks very different to basically going to zero or comparing it to USDC where you get zero.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. How do you think about, obviously, I think APY was something that, you know, people were very interested in when you launched. Of course, that is, you know, fluctuating constantly. Now it's, I think, at like low 30s or 30-ish handle. How does that behave over time? And of course, it depends on a wide variety of things, market conditions and whatnot. But as you scale, like, and you become a much larger buyer of, like, you know, a greater share of these exchanges, like how does that, like, if you were to like isolate perhaps other variables, but like how scalable is this strategy is perhaps a question.
Yeah, it's absolutely not infinitely scalable like a treasury or Tether. So it's ultimately constrained by the size of open interest for derivatives within crypto. At the moment, there's around roughly 35 billion of just BTC and ETH. So that's just like the two majors. You can also do this with like Solana, for example, which is roughly 1.5 billion of OI right now. The way we roughly think about this, and exchanges start to like cap you out in terms of the percentage of OI that you can actually sit on these contracts, is roughly between 35% to 40% of the post-money open interest. So if you're looking at the market right now and just assume that you can be, call it like 30 rather than 40%, that's like roughly $10 billion of open interest that basically Athena could provide to the market, which is obviously more than in 10x where we are right now. I do think that we start to have marginal impacts on funding rates in the not too distant future from where we are now. So we're roughly like 9% of total ETH global interest is sitting in Athena right now. And I think if we double from there, we start to materially impact the funding rates. I think this is also just like a slight misunderstanding from people where they almost see it as a criticism that yield is going to come down through time. That is literally the point, which is you've identified that an unlevered cash and carry is paying you 25, 35, 65%. That number should be lower. Like that is the observation of Athena. And in the process of bringing that number down to something that makes sense, I don't know, maybe it's like 12 instead of like 5 on an RWA, someone's going to create billions of dollars of value in that process. And so we don't look at it as like that arbitrage should be closing down or that interest rate should fall. We look at it as that is the opportunity, which is to go and push it down, something that makes sense. So it is also just another way that I've urged some people to think about Athena, which is like, you might think that the whole story that we're telling around synthetic dollars and Arthur's like original vision, you might think that that's complete bullshit. I don't. I think it's an important thing for the space. You can actually just think about Athena as actually like an interest rate arbitrage vehicle, which is bringing interest rates between DeFi, CeFi, and TradFi in line. One very basic example I can give you here is that you can go borrow DAI now at like 9 figures of size for 6.5%, and you can throw that in Athena for 65 this week. You can do that at 9 figures of size. There are people who are paying 60% to be long in ETH PERP right now, and you can put down ETH on Maker and actually get paid 40 to 50% by borrowing DAI and then putting it into Athena on the other side. There are obviously like risk elements in what I've just described over there, but that dislocation is just completely insane, right? That like you can borrow in DeFi at 6.5, and CeFi is like almost 10x out right now. So really you can think about Athena potentially as just connective tissue, which kind of brings interest rates in line, and the supply of USD is just the balancing item, which makes that all fit together.
Guy, how long do you think it takes for... So you have these basically three rates, right? You've got the kind of TradFi rate, you've got the CeFi rate, and then you've got this DeFi rate that we're talking about, and the three very different rates right now. How many years will it take for those to, hypothetically, they should basically converge over time, at least the CeFi and the DeFi rate, maybe not the TradFi rate, but how long will it take for those to converge?
Well, I'm hoping Athena accelerates that, right? So we've been speaking about like the institutions coming for however many years, and like Arthur was here, I don't know when Arthur was doing it. I remember reading some blog. You can jump in.
I was doing it back in 2013. It was 300% per annum returns for that same arb.
So you were doing this trade basically, but you know, it was...
on Bitcoin, the first futures exchange called ICBit, it was 200 to 300% per annum returns doing cash and carry unlevered.
Arthur, do you guys ever think about launching an Athena-like product when you're at BitMEX?
We thought about creating a synthetic dollar within the BitMEX ecosystem to do different things within our ecosystem, but no, we didn't think about starting our own stablecoin. And I think to Guy's point, for this to be successful, it can't be a BitMEX product or a Binance product or a Huobi product or a Bybit product. It has to be everybody together, because then you just get picked off as the one exchange that's offering the synthetic dollar rails for crypto, and you don't stand strong together. So it can't be one exchange owning this thing. It has to be a consortium of everyone for it to succeed.
Yeah. Guy, your guys' position is very public, I've noticed. Like, you guys, your website, you have a very, very, very transparent website. I think you've done a great job with that. The downside is that your position is very public. As soon as I see that, I'm like, all right, there's some hedge fund out there that's basically trying to think about how to cause a cascade and how to basically essentially hunt Athena's position down. How do you
How do you think about
it? Just Ken Griffin where we need him.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, yeah, how do you...
Fuck the retail. Come on. Ken's going to buy a new mansion in Miami.
Exactly. He's done anything bad.
There's probably football to your preference. The first is like you basically don't want to get front run on like actual flows that are moving from inputs on Ethereum before you've actually executed the hedge on the other side. So all of the stuff that you're seeing there on the dashboard has obviously got a time delay, so people aren't actually watching exactly where that's going to be executed. But that's like on the margin where you'd be losing execution costs rather than something that's like systemically wrong with USDC itself. The type of attack vectors that I've sort of read about, I don't think make a lot of sense, and you guys obviously jump in if you disagree. It would basically take like billions of dollars of capital to take the same trade as Athena and like push down the market with billions of dollars of shorts and then wait until we bleed out or they bleed out. And there isn't really like a snap moment where you actually can short things. So like the reason that Luna was the most amazing short was that you could short UST, but like the upside was one and the downside was zero. And then you could also short Luna because that was going to zero as well. Here it's like a slow attrition of principal. And the capital that you're using to short is going through the same attrition of principal as well. So I don't really know what like the outcome is of someone trying to do that.
Yeah, it'd be kind of uneconomically stupid to do it.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't put that past.
Unless it's like a state actor that just has nothing to lose.
This is the one I saw yesterday. Said users of Athena are lending their assets to ETH and may not get them back if the market dips, which is extremely plausible given volatility. There's no free lunch. This would happen if Athena is unable to unwind its short position without losing much of its assets because there wouldn't be enough market depth. Athena's position is very public, very large, not very dynamic. At some point, more dynamic hedge funds are going to force Athena out of its position, which will cause a cascade and severe losses.
On the downside or the upside, is this person talking about?
Yeah, I can get to like the broad point of what they're getting to. And when I did say earlier within the discussion that I was less concerned around funding, liquidity is actually the thing that I spent more of my time thinking about. I think this is what that person is getting to. So you can think about users coming into and out of Athena. There is a cost of liquidity to get in and there's a cost of liquidity to get out. It's the same way when you're using Uniswap, there's a slippage. And if conditions are fine, you can do that tight. And if they're not, you're going to have to pay up for that liquidity. The same thing exists here, which is you're putting in a liquid staking token or ETH, and then you need to execute a hedge on the other side at some level of size. And there is a cost to doing that on the other side. We as Athena pass through that cost to users on the other side. We can never internalize that cost because of the precise reason that you're describing there, which is if you get to a moment when liquidity is extremely thin, everyone wants out, all those different types of things, you can never internalize that negative equity to Athena's balance sheet. You have to push it onto the users as a transaction cost and liquidity cost to get in and out. So really, I think what they're getting to there is that if everyone was wanting out at the exact same time of Athena, you'd be needing to unwind a lot of derivative positions on the other side. And there are times when that would be an expensive process. We do have like a redeem fee that exists within Athena, which is every time assets are coming in and out, we're basically taking basis points to cover for some of these costs. And it's not like a hard-coded number that sits there now. It's actually us reading centralized venues to say, where can we actually unwind this now? And we need to push on that cost to the user. And so the way that would be expressed is like a bad outcome for a user is everyone's wanting to get out at the same time. And basically the price that Athena is showing you that you can get your collateral back is like 99 and a half rather than 100 because there's like 50 pips of execution to get out. So it will basically be expressed by like the level that you can actually redeem the USD from the protocol. And there's nothing that you can do to hide from these costs of liquidity. It exists with all these things like I mentioned with Uniswap. The only thing I think that we can do is like be transparent that risk does exist and there is like a cost of liquidity to get in and out. But yeah, I think that is something that's important to keep an eye on. And I think one other element I'll just like address around this is we have like a lock on the staking on chain. So if you're going to be capturing the yield, there's a 7-day cooldown to actually get your assets back out of the SUSD contract. The reason that exists there is you can think about this like a bank trying to manage its asset and liability duration mismatches where we don't have a perfect duration match on the assets and the liabilities because you do have some STETH or liquid staking tokens, which are not perfectly liquid like Tether. And your liabilities, you need to make sure that they match up in a better way than basically just having on-demand deposit that can come out. And so if you're locking users into SUSD, which is like where we expect most users to be, there's a 7-day sort of cooldown from people saying, I want my money back, and then actually being able to effectuate that transaction, which gives you time to sort of smooth out some of the unwind that I was describing there. So you can just really think about that like any financial services company that's just trying to manage asset and liability mismatches on their balance sheet.
Well, can you walk us through this decision to, so the way that Arthur describes Athena, talking about stable coins, talking about a better Tether and a better USDC, the way that you talk about it is different. I think you guys have kind of rebranded away from stable coin more to like synthetic dollar or even synthetic internet bond. What's the rationale for that?
Yeah, I think to be clear, like the other projects that are doing the exact same thing in 21 called themselves stable coins. Kyle Samana came out with that piece talking about like solving the stablecoin trilemma and all these kind of things. So we didn't think it was that offensive to have the name when we'd seen like other projects sort of do the same thing for the last 2 years. But people seem to have like an allergic reaction to this. And it wasn't actually even last week. It was in October last year where Orson Campbell called us out. And I came out publicly and I said, I actually agree with you, which is we as an industry need to think about the way that we present products to users and market it to them in a more serious way. My personal view, and this is just my view, is that anything which is not like less than 90-day maturity, T-bills or like reverse repos sitting in like a bankruptcy remote SPV, that is a stable coin and everything else should have like a different name. The problem is that we have like a pretty large design space for stable coins or like that bucket of like dollar denominated assets. So if you see something like a MakerDAO with a CDP, all of these other CDPs like Liquity, Prisma, and a bunch of them that are out there now, they've been trading at like 98 cents to 99 cents for the last like 6 months, not Maker, all of the other ones. And so like, what do we do there? It's not a stable coin. It's been a point below peg for 6 months. Is there like a rule book about how we think about naming these things? I think the only thing that I'm trying to get to here is that there is a large design space. We're trying to target a dollar. The peg has sort of stayed like closer to a dollar versus like 99% of what you've seen on chain. I agree that we should think about the naming conventions being different, but we also haven't come together as an industry to actually define what is it that the way that we actually approach these things. So I would be happy to sort of be part of that discussion, but I didn't really appreciate some people coming out and saying it was being deceptive in the marketing or misleading. I think that we had been pretty clear, like in the documents on the very front page, saying that this is not the same as USDC and USDT. And if there, we thought that like a synthetic dollar captured the essence of that better and people have different ideas, I'm happy to sort of like jump in.
It comes down to are people going to use it or not, right? If people are using USDE, like it doesn't really matter what you call it. I think it's like Arthur, I saw that you guys at Maelstrom are using it for, I think
yeah. Paying vendors. Yeah, getting paid USDE. Deals.
Yeah.
Giddy up.
Yeah.
I used to think the biggest issue with Terra or just stablecoins in general was like usability. If it's just financial speculation capturing yield, certainly like there are better mechanisms than others. Like yours is better than Terra for sure. Like anyone that is contesting that is just hasn't read through and thought about it clearly, or an algorithmic stablecoin. But like, can you talk more about like, there's this concept of like usability brings further stability. You know, can we see to, you know, as you guys were using it, Arthur, like how much of like composability is a focus here, integrations with other DeFi protocols, you know, do you ever think that, of course, there's a cap to how much you can grow today, but over time, if the market keeps growing, then, you know, this could be much larger. Yeah, what's like the end goal here? And from a BD standpoint, how much of is it a focus today, or will those things just kind of solve themselves as you guys continue to grow?
Yeah, I think on the composability piece, this is like, that's actually what's interesting about Athena. I think Yana had a comment earlier, which is like, why can't I do this myself? The answer is like, your grandma can actually do this trade if you like hold her hand on a Sunday to put it on. That's not what's interesting. Anyone can put on the trade themselves. What's interesting is when you tokenize it and you put it into an instrument that's actually liquid and composable and allows you to then plug it into different areas of both CeFi and DeFi, that's actually where the magic starts to happen. So I can give you just like two examples here, which we're pushing quite hard for at the moment is, very basic money markets at the moment where you're putting down some asset that has a yield and your ability to borrow that at a lower cost of like liability and then lever that up in some way to get an interesting post leverage return. That hasn't really worked in DeFi for the last 2 years because there's only really one source of like dollar denominated return, which is basically like looping RWAs. And so the cost of borrowing USDC should converge to RWA rates and there's not really like much of a trade to do here. If Athena's USD is producing 25, 35, north of that, and you can borrow dollars from DeFi at 6.5, your ability to actually start using money markets in really interesting ways is completely unlocked by this new asset. Another one that I'm incredibly excited about is thinking about yield-bearing collateral on both DEXs as collateral to actually margin a perp, and then on SEXs as well. So if you're trading a perp and then paying the funding on the other side, it's an order of magnitude increase in capital efficiency to actually be able to put down an instrument that's actually capturing the basis from another exchange and then paying you while you're sort of longing another asset. So this is something that we're working on with Synthetics on chain, which I'm pretty excited about for the next quarter. And I think that this is actually one of the largest growth areas that people don't understand about Tether, is that there's $20 billion of demand for Tether, where the only use case is putting it down for margining a linear perpetual on SEXs. And so when you go to the largest trading funds in the space and you tell them that instead of holding $100 million of Tether and getting paid zero, you can be earning $10 to $20 million on that, it's actually quite a big deal. And that's kind of why there's been a few trading firms who I think have been involved in the growth that you've seen in the last few weeks. That's all that's to say is that, like, the point you're getting to there is actually the key one, which is the trade is the least interesting thing about Athena. It's actually composing and plugging this into both DeFi and CeFi, which is what I personally find interesting about it. And I think the BD question you're getting to there is that actually, I think a big mistake that a lot of the on-chain stable-like assets have made in the past is that they ignore CeFi as a distribution channel. And there's maybe 10, 20, 30,000 people who are sitting on chain doing stuff every day. There's 100 to 200 million people sitting on these centralized exchanges. And every success story of a stablecoin has been distributed through an exchange who basically forces the product into their users' hands. And so if you think about the real, like, nature and fabric of USDE, it makes a lot more sense for a centralized exchange to be pushing this, because they're getting trading fees as we're executing the hedge. We're using their liquid staking tokens and growing the TVL of that and bringing, like, yield to their balance sheet. And then we can share some of the yield with them as a distribution partner. And so if you ask me, like, what are the big avenues that this could grow? I think one is, like, yield-bearing infrastructure within L2s, where I think that's going to be a big theme this year, whether it's like Blast or others who are sort of copying them. And then the second one is perp collateral on centralized exchanges, where centralized exchanges are actually doing your job for distribution and pushing the product for you there because they're incentivized to do so.
Yeah, definitely. So I think you brought up a really good point. Like, so if you're holding USDC or Tether, there's certainly a lot of risk there, whether you want to believe them or not, but you're not getting paid. And they're making a whole lot of money in the back end. I mean, Coinbase started disclosing
a whole lot of money.
Tether is like top 10 largest holder of treasuries.
Tether makes $62 million per employee in 2020.
The most popular. That's nuts. That's crazy.
Ever in human history.
Exactly. Coinbase started disclosing their net interest income recently in the last quarter. Now, the street's waking up to that. As a user, you're not getting paid. Do you think that you'll force their hand? If at some point you become big enough, do you think, like, USDC, particularly, or Tether, will have to share some of the yield that they're clipping back to users? Otherwise, or do you think that users are not just as sophisticated?
Arthur might have a different view to me. I think USDC is already buckled on that, basically, which is you might have seen some of that marketing spend that they're doing on Coinbase, where you're getting 5% for having it. And they're doing that in different pockets, which aren't, like, as public. So even though Tether is, 3 to 4x the size of USDC at the moment, I think they're more than 10 to 20x more profitable, because Tether, like, truly internalizes the full 5%, but USDC is paying out. I would expect, like, almost half of that to the distribution partners that they're working with, based on the numbers that you're seeing from Coinbase. I think USDC is buckled. And part of the reason there is that actually, I think USDC holders are much more interest rate sensitive than USDT holders. So I saw a pretty incredible stat, which I hadn't realized, which is the overlap of USDC and USDT holders is only 4% in terms of wallets that are actually holding the same asset, which is just an absolutely tiny amount. And actually, USDT is, like, generally Asian-based entities who are sitting outside of the regulatory apparatus of the US, while USDC is more plugged in over there. And so if you think about a USDC holder, when rates went from 0 to 5, there was an enormous gravitational pull for capital out of crypto into treasuries, basically. And USDC was just an incredible off-ramp to go and actually capture that. And so I think that's part of the reason that you saw them actually decline. And they face a lot more pressure when it comes to internalizing their yields, because their holders are actually more yield-sensitive. And then I think the second piece to that is the real reason that I think Tether won is that they were, like, they got the holy grail, I think, which is basically their money on exchanges. And it was the point that Arthur was getting to, which is when you're the trading power on all of these major sex venues and you're like BTC, USDT, ETH, USDT on Binance, that's just an incredible moat that's so difficult to unseat because you don't really care about holding like a yield for 5% when you're buying Tether to go and like long an asset that's going to move 5 to 10% of the day. And that really is the moat for Tether, which is it is actually money on these exchange venues. Yeah. So who knows? I don't think the cycle will ever get to the size that's like north of 20 or whatever it is where they actually feel threatened by us. I think Tether basically just has such a strong moat that they probably won't ever be paying out that yield. USDC, I think, is a different story.
Yeah. I want to talk about the minting and redeeming process. This was something that came up quite extensively when right before FTX collapsed, like Sam was like going into a lot of detail, like they were actually one of the few. And when there was the Tether FUD comes up at like every other year or so. And he was going into detail. But I think you guys are requiring users that are minting and redeeming to KYC, but anyone, you know, can go buy it in a Curr pool, frac, whatever it is in the secondary market. Can you comment on who is actually going through that process now? What kind of entities, what kind of players are getting involved? And what are the, just going back to risks, like the, like how cumbersome or the latency in that process? I'm just kind of curious if you could just spend a minute talking about like the whole minting and redeeming aspect.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I can just give you context for like the three reasons why we actually did it. And then we can jump into those pieces. So the first is actually just around security. So this is like the most sensitive piece of Athena, which is we're printing you USD and you're giving us an asset. If we're mispricing that asset, that's how you like lose money. If you're mispricing the mint and redeem. And so for us, like not having that fully open to the public is actually a security measure, which is we know the counterparties who are sitting on the other side there. And if there ever is an issue with the mint and redeem being mispriced, we can actually go to that counterparty and say, okay, there's been an issue here and try and recover that. So that's one piece which we just felt made the architecture sitting on chain much more secure for users. The second one is actually just trying to abstract away complexity for users because we thought it was not very ergonomic for users to arrive with a liquid staking token and then swap that into dollars. And so what a user is actually seeing is swaps from dollars into dollars within an AMM, whether it's Uniswap or Curve. And then what you've done is actually abstract away the complexity of bringing in liquid staking tokens or ETH into our system onto a market maker because you're basically just ensuring that that arbitrage mechanism makes sense where they want to bring you those liquid staking tokens to close out the ARP. So that's just another piece which we thought like conceptually users didn't like the idea of like swapping ETH into dollars. You just want to be swapping dollars into dollars. And that was like another piece for us there. So yeah, that's sort of the way it works. And it's actually very, it's similar and you can compare it to the way that Tether and USDC do their approved parties where it's a known counterparty sitting on the other side. It's KYC'd on the mint and redeem. And it's obviously freely and permissionlessly transferable through DeFi afterwards.
Arthur, would be curious to just zoom out from Athena and get your broader take on the stablecoin market. Like, what do you think ultimately happens with stablecoins? Like, so to run through maybe two or three examples, like Fed, there could be a Fed stablecoin, right? They probably don't want to do that because they make trillions of dollars in FX fees, but there could be that. They could try to shut down, they could call Cantor Fitzgerald, try to shut down Tether. They could go after Circle. They could King make Circle. Like, what is your broad view of what happens in the stablecoin space?
So, what I don't understand is what the political situation is in the back rooms of why like a Jamie Dimon or, you know, Solomon A. Goldman or one of these guys doesn't have their own coin and do this trade because it's very profitable. As we know, Tether makes so much money. So the one issue is that the Fed doesn't really like fully reserved banks because when you just take in dollars and you don't lend them out, you basically deposit those dollars at the Fed and the Fed has to pay you interest on them. And this is costing the Fed hundreds of billions of dollars a year and has rendered them unprofitable as they keep raising rates. So Tether, Circle, First Digital, any of these, I call them physically backed US dollar stable coins, actually poses a profitability issue for the Fed and the Treasury because they're just going to park the money in short-term money markets, which is either interest on excess reserves at the Fed, reverse repos and money market funds, or, you know, treasury bills with less than 1 year maturity. This is costing the Fed and the Treasury trillions of dollars a year as they keep raising rates to fight inflation. So to allow you know, a JP Morgan or a Citibank or one of these guys to issue one of these coins. And obviously they would instantly have, you know, probably trillions of dollars flooding into them. So, yeah, we would love a 24/7 dollar that trades on a public blockchain. We fucking hate coming to the bank on, you know, at 5:30 and we can't get our fucking wire through, right? It's a service. Everybody wants it. They refuse to provide it either because they feel like they don't have to or they've been told they can't do it. I don't know which one of those it is, but I do know that fully reserved banks present a problem for the Fed and the Treasury in that they have to pay so much money to keep reserves stagnant in the system. So that's a higher level money market thing, which has nothing to do with crypto, which is why I think they don't like Tether. Now, does it mean they're going to call to shut it down tomorrow? Well, now they got a problem. They've let Tether grow so big, it's, I think, the 22nd largest holder of treasuries. The treasury market liquidity has declined, you know, since COVID, as the market has ballooned in size. And so, yes, could you go after Tether and, you know, call Cantor and Deltek and, you know, all these other banks and say shut them down? Sure, they could do that, you know, 2 seconds and Tether would be debanked. But then what do you do with all those treasuries when everyone in crypto says, okay, I want my fucking money back today, right? I need to sell, you know, $100 billion worth of, you know, of treasury bills. The market's not that liquid. So it's, they've kind of fucked themselves. And on the one hand, they don't want to have fully reserved banks like a JP or a Citi do this trade because then they're going to be paying them even more money on their excess reserves. But on the other hand, they've let Tether grow so big that now it's, you know, bigger than most countries in terms of holdings of treasuries. And they can't easily just kick them out of the US dollar financial system because of the pandemonium it would cause in the treasury market. So it all comes down to US politics. I don't know how that gets resolved. CDBC, again, it's an issue of does the Fed or any other central bank want to bank the citizens directly and put all the commercial banks out of business? Not even China is willing to put their commercial banks out of business to launch a CDBC that people want to use. So ultimately, I think the CDBC thing, while it would be like Tether killer, or, you know, this would be so useful to have your smartphone and connect directly with the central bank and move fiat around instantaneously, no KYC issues, blah, blah, blah. The banks have such a strong political, you know, bulwark in every single major government around the world that they're never going to let themselves be disintermediated by the central bank, who is a regulator. And so that's why we have wholesale CDBCs, which make no fucking sense because they're not going to be used by anyone. You know, the banks just sending around some tokens around each other, like, never going to be used. So I don't think CDBCs are what's going to sort of dethrone any of these stablecoins. It's really going to come down to incentives from the exchanges and the users. As Guy said, Tether doesn't pay out money. They started so early and have such a moat of usefulness that they don't have to pay anyone anything. But, you know, if I'm getting 20, 30, 40, 50% holding USDE as the user, as the exchange, now the exchange can own some governance tokens. Okay, well, you know, Giancarlo and Paolo and all those guys at Tether, like, where the fuck's my money? And if they're not going to pay up, then it starts to skew when you have these really, really high basis rates. Does it mean that they're automatically going to start dumping Tether? No. But, you know, we have Athena 800 or whatever it is, million TVL of all these exchange partners and all these pairs starting to come out on sexes. Why is that happening? Because they have incentive to put it on there. And, you know, you don't dethrone Tether all at once. It starts very, very small. So I think there's all these confluent factors that the status quo of, you know, intense competition between algorithmic stable coins, physical US dollars in a bank account, synthetic US dollar stable coins, over collateralized things like that. We're just going to compete and compete and compete. Whoever offers the best incentives for the users and the exchanges will ultimately win. I think that the, you know, overarching fiat regulatory apparatus has so many issues in and amongst themselves that they can't resolve that, you know, kicking out Tether or Circle probably isn't what's going to happen.
Yeah. So much of the stablecoin, I guess, landscape over the years has been, you know, there's countless bodies there. And a lot of it has been like unknown unknowns that pop up and creep up in the system. I guess like Terra, like everyone was going.
I don't know that. Terra was not an unknown unknown.
Terra was not an unknown unknown. Well, yeah, I'm not saying.
I read a paper. Like, what the fuck is this Luna thing? Why is it so valuable? I had my analyst do a paper, and one of the first fucking things he put out was a Google. I don't know what the professor was, and it was this algorithmic stablecoin death row. The fucking paper, it described verbatim exactly how it felt. And I knew that thing was a piece of dog shit, and I bought it anyway because it was going up. That's what I sold before it went down. So don't tell me that you didn't know how this shit was going to fail. No, it was fucking written on the internet.
No, I said stable. I didn't talk about Terra. The issue with Terra was that everyone jumped into the trade was so juicy. What they didn't factor in was the size of the door to go out was not growing. So that room became incredibly crowded. It was like a frat party. It was like thousands of people all of a sudden in the same room, and everyone wants to get out at the same time. It's not going to happen, right? So I guess, like, what are some of the things that, like, you're going to be paying a lot of attention to make sure that, you know, is it who's showing up to mint and redeem? What kind of, how savvy they are? What kind of players are showing up? Is it the exchange relationships, the counterparty relationships? Like, what are some of the things that in your mind could be like unknown unknowns here that might introduce some fragility into the whole mechanism? That you just are not, that you're just not in a position to comment on now, but maybe you have some theories of what those may be and you're looking out as you grow.
Yeah, I think, one is always just thinking about counterparty risk. So that obviously exists, as we said, with different stable coins in different ways. So we thought that USDC didn't really have counterparty risk. And then we sort of learned that there was actually very real counterparty risk to like SVB, which is where the underlying assets are sitting in the background. So I always think about these things rather than saying we've removed this type of risk. It's like really just transferring risks into different places. And so we look at like the custodial setups that we put in place, which is obviously one of the largest risks here, which is if you lose your collateral, whether it's sitting in a smart contract or a custodian or a centralized exchange, that's the way that this like materially goes wrong rather than like on the margin issues with funding and that kind of stuff. So I think the way I approached this was, as you know, Santi, like DeFi was like the first thing that I personally found interesting about the space. That's like where I had all my assets and what I was like initially drawn to by the space. But I think we also got to like acknowledge that like trustless interaction within DeFi is unacceptably unsecure at the moment. So I saw an Into the Block piece that came out. The probability of default of actually just leaving your assets within a smart contract on Ethereum is roughly like working out at like 7% per annum. You get zeroed 7% of the time that you put your money into a smart contract. And yes, it sounds like great on paper that we're interacting with just smart contracts. There's no like human interference and all that kind of stuff. But actually just like empirically looking at the data and saying, is it safer to have your assets in a smart contract, a centralized exchange, or an institutional grade custodian? It's like unquestionable that the answer is an institutional grade custodian. And so I know that that doesn't like please people when I say that, and it's not like with the ethos of DeFi and all those different types of things. But we looked at that as like an acceptable trade-off to actually have users' assets sitting within that, which we think like provides an adequate like trade-off. So to me, that is like the big one, which is how you think about the counterparty exposure. And I think we just looked at the data and could see empirically it's not a bad place to have your assets. And that's the reason that funds, you at Parify, hedge funds, they have their money in custodians. It's not like...
anyone that says not to use a custodian is like full... Like crypto is these like tinfoil hat people that are not practical. Like custodians, like it's like a Horcrux model. You should be using a custodian and you should be using a smart contract and everything at your disposal. But yeah, there are just some people that are really extreme and are not very practical, but it's refreshing to see you guys being one. Do you think about like just the insurance fund? Insurance has been one of the things that like hasn't really materialized, like going to, I don't know, some, you know, third point or whatever and like have crypto insurance products. That's something that hasn't really, you know, flourished. At some point, I mean, you have the insurance fund that you're growing, you're taking a fee, right? And so that should grow over time. But do you anticipate like insurance players jumping into the fold here to provide an extra layer of security? Like that would be pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, it's actually a really good point because I think one of the reasons that insurance within DeFi hasn't taken off is because the cost of capital or like the return of DeFi got squashed so significantly that there was basically no margin to like plug insurance in. So if you remember like the very beginning of DeFi summer, it was like 50 to 100% yields. You could afford to pay a Nexus Mutual 10, 20% to like plug yourself.
We're talking about this back in the day.
Yeah. But obviously when rates went below 5, like there's not enough to like even feed a user, let alone like an insurance layer that sits there. So I think that like that is actually a very interesting idea here, which is if you're making super normal returns through USDE and someone can actually underwrite that, it's a risk that can definitely be underwritten. That could be like one of the first reasonable use cases for an insurance fund here. I think the other thing just to like make people aware is that it doesn't only have to be funded through like excess spread of the product through time. You know, Lido did large treasury sales when they were out with the token and you like had decentralized infrastructure sitting around it. If you think that this is a business that's producing a lot of cash flow, which as of the numbers that's like coming out this week, it's one of basically the largest revenue generating apps on Ethereum right now, 2 weeks into being live. It's not that difficult, I don't think, to be able to sell part of your treasury to people to actually try and capitalize that insurance fund as well. So you've got different avenues that you can sort of think about capitalizing that, whether it's capturing a spread or actually just selling tokens for hard dollars.
Arthur, what's your take on where we're at in the market right now?
This is the beginning of the bull market. It's going to be
real fun. The beginning?
The beginning. This is just the beginning. I don't know what Bitcoin is right now. I don't have my charts up, but we're close to all-time highs. Once we get past all-time high, like, you know, crypto market cap, then it starts to get really, really interesting. Because then you have a bunch of people who bought shit in 2021 who now are above water and they start doing silly shit all over again. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's going to be dog with hat and cat with hat and whatever, you know, fucked up shit we come up with over the next 18 months to relieve fools of their money. But we'll do it and it's going to be fun. And I think it's just beginning. This is just the start. And if you think about the ETF as this factor that's contributing all this capital, the way that people allocate to these funds like BlackRock and Fidelity, it's the retirement account. It's sticky flows. It's not like they're going to go in. You know, they had to go into work. They had to fill out a fucking form from HR, hand it back, like tick, 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 tick. Which one do you want to choose? Like, you ain't fucking doing that shit because Bitcoin went down 25%. Like, you're too busy in your fucking TikTok looking at thirst traps. So I think like the flows are sticky, and they won't be sticky forever, but we'll get to a plateau of a level where, okay, everybody has allocated what they're going to allocate, and now they're a little bit more price sensitive. Okay, maybe the price drops and you start selling things, but we're not even at that point right now. This is just the start. You've just started to see, you know, bald motherfuckers like Larry Fink going on CNBC talking about like fiscal responsibility and all sorts of other bullshit that we've been banging on drums for the last like 15 years. Like, the sales force is just starting around the world of, hey, you know, put your assets here, we'll protect you against inflation. You know, obviously I have my issues with that, but that's the narrative. It's working. It's the best selling product ever for these ETF providers. They're going to do more of it, whether it's Ethereum or Solana or whatever altcoin. So we're just getting started. We haven't even gotten to the fun stuff yet. People are just getting back above water, right? So it's fun, but it's just the beginning. So don't think that you maybe made 10x on some shitcoin that you bought and you sold that. Now the shit's going 1,000 times higher. Like, it's not even there yet.
What's your over under on ETF products, Ethereum, Solana, and then everything else after that over the next 2 years?
I think as many as they can get out, they will, right? And so whatever the framework is that whoever the new SEC chair puts out for these U.S. regulated institutions, they're going to maximize it. Like, they've just made so much money listing, you know, Bitcoin. It's, you know, not that hard. I'm sure they have their qualified custodians or whoever it is, whether it's Coinbase. Now you have the banks lobbying the regulators in the U.S. to be able to custody crypto. They're looking at, why the fuck should Coinbase get all this revenue from our club? We should be getting the money on holding these crypto assets. So now the banks are involved. Like, everybody wants to take their little cut of this ecosystem on the, you know, the TradFiization of Bitcoin. So I think they're going to try to list as many assets as possible because it's extremely profitable to do so. It's not an ideological thing whether they believe Bitcoin's better than Ethereum or the other one. Like, it's money in, they charge 20 bips or whatever it is on their product, and, you know, the AUM grows and they get a bonus and they're, you know, go there fucking buy their house at Hamptons or whatever they do. So I think we just get more and more and more of these products. Whether or not they're successful, at a certain point, we'll have reached saturation and they won't be successful anymore, but we're not there yet.
Is there a downside of this, though, of like the institutions buying up all our Bitcoin?
Well, it's, if you look at the asset markets today, passive investing taken to an extreme, and right now it is at an extreme, is entirely terrible for price discovery. What stock goes up the most? The stock that's highly valued. It doesn't mean the stock earns its rate of return. It just has to have a price that goes up. So if I'm allocating a percentage of my portfolio to S&P 500, the stock that's worth the most gets the most money, not necessarily the stock that has the best return. And so you see the dispersion of returns, you know, evaporate, price discovery evaporates, and everyone just buys Qs and SPYs, right? And so passive investing is a cancer when it gets to where it is right now in TradFi.
Yeah.
Will it get to the same point in crypto where, you know, these top 12 fund managers own, you know, 20 or 30% of the supply of crypto? I don't know. We'll see. What will we do when that happens? I guess it's up to the community. You know, the whole point of this is that anyone can join.
I was thinking about it less in the light of like number go up technology, more in the light of like your original stablecoin thesis of, look, someone picks up the phone, calls Cantor, shuts down Tether tomorrow. Is there like anything in the back of your head where you're thinking about that with Bitcoin and BlackRock, or that's that risk has sailed? No.
Well, what would they do? BlackRock sell you Bitcoin? Okay, cool. Then the price goes down. Whatever. We've had 95% price correction in Bitcoin before. Is that like, okay, cool, we'll have another one. And the new price, the new floor is $100,000 Bitcoin rather than, you know, $20,000 or whatever it was, $16,000 this cycle. So
I think what you said about the, look, when I was a pair, like DeFi felt closer to like what could be most problematic or even some like Tether, but it's just, your point's an excellent one, I think, which is it just got to a point where it's just too big to shut down. And like, there's, you know, what is the motivation to like shut down a Bitcoin ETF? Yana? Like, it just like, I think like lobbies and...
I mean, BlackRock is the U.S. financial system. You don't just shut down Larry
Fink. Yeah.
The motherfucker's exactly. Powerful, right? He's making the most money fucking Bitcoin ETF. Like, you ain't coming
BlackRock and NVIDIA are now more interesting and more important than the Fed. I mean, it's just sort of like people listening to NVIDIA earnings calls to higher degree.
Yeah, I'm done with macro for a while. Macro doesn't fucking matter, right? Fed cuts, Fed hikes. Who gives a fuck, right? Yeah. Tell me what that 3 p.m. or whatever time it gets released, ETF flow was every day is more important than what the fuck Jay Powell and Lagarde and all those motherfuckers do.
Yeah. Arthur, what, just going back to like this cycle. All right. So like a typical cycle, typical with quotes around it, was Bitcoin led, flows into ETH, flows into degeneracy, flows into meme coins, top, run it back 4 years later. This has been like Solana runs, then like Bitcoin runs, then we jump over to meme coins. Like, how do you think about just, I don't know, how this cycle looks different than the last, or how it looks similar?
Well, I mean, let's bear in mind, like, people lost a lot of money in 2021 to 2023, right? So people are just starting to like get their mojo back. So maybe that will be the cycle. We're not even, Solana is what, at 110 or whatever? It peaked at 250, right? ETH's not at its all-time high in price terms yet. Bitcoin's not at its all-time high. It's close to it. Right. So we don't know what happens when all these coins recover to where people have bought them in 2021. You have all the FTX bag holders are, you know, crying the blues because they got, you know, they got struck at the lows of the market. Right. So it's going to take a lot of time and capital to make people feel rich again to start buying. I mean, I guess there was Alien Punks that sold for some crazy amount of ETH. I've got Ether rocks. So hopefully the rocks go up too. So, I mean, I think when we start seeing, you know, JPEGs flying again, then we're now, okay, this feels like what we're after. But I think I don't think we're there yet. It's people are still butthurt. Like, oh, no, there's going to be a big correction. Oh, no, like, you know, Bitcoin can't just, like, slice through the all-time high. It's happening sooner than I thought. But, again, people lost a lot of money. The major institutions of crypto failed and went under, right? So we're still not psychologically there, at least on a, you know, a median level, to believe that this is the start of the bull market. People are still in disbelief.
What are the sectors that get you most interested from an investing standpoint? Is it, you know, crypto AI narratives that like are new as opposed to narratives that are old, like DeFi and GameFi are really hurt, like, you know, and so they probably have more resistance like going up because there's a bunch of back holders that are going to sell along the way. As a like go back to par, but or are you more excited about just new stuff like crypto AI and, you know, all that kind of crap?
I mean, so the AI thing, AI is tough. It's you know, it's hard to make money in AI. I think on a longer term basis, I'm an exchange guy. I've made my money in exchanges. I love exchanges. I think the one thing, and, you know, Guy and Athena are working on this as well, is the interest rate market is, you know, I don't know, 10 times bigger than FX trading market. We're just starting to see that market, you know, with how Athena and Pendle interact and EtherFi and EigenLayer points and all these things. Now, I'm super bullish on, obviously, I own a lot of Pendle. I think that Pendle or whoever captures the interest rate trading of crypto and builds the bedrock of those products is going to be trading multiples of what Binance is doing today on a centralized derivatives fashion, just because the most liquid futures contract in the world is not the S&P 500. It's the euro dollar futures contract. I don't know how many quadrillions of notional it trades every year, but it's the bedrock of Pax Americana's US dollar reserve system is that futures contract. What is the one for crypto? Is it going to be something that an Athena, EUSD, you know, APY and Pendle, something or other like that? I don't know, but I'm excited about that because it's a segment of the market that not very many people understand, because, you know, the interest rate markets and money markets, it's kind of complicated and opaque, and they make, you know, the authorities make it opaque for a reason. I know how fucked up it is. But at the end of the day, I'm super excited about that because it's not well appreciated. I know where it goes in the TradFi sense. We're going to move there. Just like, you know, derivatives, when I started in 2013, no one traded derivatives. A few here and there. Now derivatives is the majority of all trading volume. I think we're going to see this, but it's only the FX pairs. What about the interest rates? We have a native yield in ETH now. We have restaking. EigenLayer is the hottest project of this cycle so far, right? And what is it? It's taking that yield-bearing asset and using it to secure other apps. This is going to be the biggest thing, I think, in this cycle, is us starting to appreciate what interest rates mean. We have a natively yielding asset like ETH that's powering, obviously, something like Athena. And so that's what I'm super excited about. And yeah, that's I love that kind of stuff. And I'm an exchange guy and markets person. And I think that's something that I'm going to be sinking my teeth into over the next, you know, 18 to 24 months.
Guy, 2 years from now, who's the biggest customer of Athena? Is it traditional funds who want the yield? Is it crypto funds? Is it that I saw you guys are doing this go-to-market thing with L2s? Is it the users of L2s? Or it's, I guess the L2 is the customer here. Who's the biggest customer of Athena?
Yeah, I imagine it's probably a centralized exchange as a user of our product and then distributor to their users. I think all of those different pockets that you outlined there are interesting, and they sort of change through time. So I think crypto funds are probably the lowest down on that list, where they can actually do this trade themselves, unless they're actually taking the tokenized like issuance of it and then using it broadly throughout DeFi. I think that they find it less interesting because they do this themselves, and sometimes more efficiently because they don't have to do it at such a large size. I do think the piece that you're getting to though with the TradFi element was something that I was actually quite surprised about as we're going through this process now of trying to find capital to come into Athena, which is because you've actually replaced like the underlying asset sitting within the smart contract, and it's sitting within institutional grade custodians that like TradFi is actually used to. So a Fireblocks, Copper, all those type of entities, they can actually engage with this in a way that they couldn't by leaving money within the smart contract. And so I've been pretty blown away, I think, by just like the types and of entities that are coming in from TradFi, and just looking at this as a very interesting packaged like dollar instrument to capture crypto yield in a single click. When that becomes incredibly interesting, I think, is actually when rates in the real world start to fall from 5 to 4 to 3, because you've got to remember like Athena's product here is actually competing with what is actually historically in the last like 10 years, a pretty high risk-free rate. The moment that this product actually like really shines is when RWAs fall from 5 to 4 to 3, the rates on this product are actually negatively correlated to rates in the real world. And so thinking about this as like a large scalable dollar denominated instrument where you've got negatively correlated yields, that's actually incredibly compelling to track by people who sit outside of crypto as well. And if you can package that up in a safe and secure way, I think people are underestimating the size of the flows that can come from that.
Nice. Cool, guys. I think that's about it. Guy, anything we missed on Athena? Arthur, anything we missed on Athena or just general market sentiment that you want to share?
I mean, fucking bull market. Let's fucking go. It's party time, bitches.
That's how we're ending it. Good podcast, Guy. Appreciate you coming on, man. Congrats on everything with Athena. Arthur, appreciate your thoughts as always.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, guys.
Guy, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, guys. Hey everyone, Jason here. Thank you so much for watching today's episode. Wanted to take a quick second to thank today's title sponsor, Arbitrum. We know you are tired of on-chain experiences that have unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds, and that's why we partnered with Arbitrum. You can experience frictionless trades, lightning speed, and lag-free transactions, all for pennies per transaction. Explore Arbitrum's expanding ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. That's portal.arbitrum.io. See you for the next episode.